So I've actually studied both kinds of theory. And the difference for me is that Drucker's method still lacks the inner perspective of an awareness of the worldview he's unconsciously deploying in his research. So in the research world, there's actually very little development, if any. And there's an interpretation of knowledge and recommendations that one makes from that. Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, as you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartow, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach. We got a very interesting input for our show today. We got a request for a second opinion, if you would please, from Alex Hutton. She's a manager at Providence Healthcare in Vancouver, British Columbia, your world, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's on an article about Japanese management lessons. And it was written a long time ago, 1971, by the acclaimed father of modern management, Peter Drucker. I know you've looked at it. Maybe you could give us a bit of background for our listeners.
For sure. So this article from our old standby Harvard Business Review, yes, they existed back in 1971, is titled What We Can Learn from Japanese Management. And we're only going to tackle the first section today, which is all about decision making. So it was published, as you said, in March of 1971. And so what Peter Drucker attempts to shed light on is how the process of Japanese decision making, which seemed at the time so slow and kind of plodding to Western eyes, actually was about a consensus-based system of deeper exploration of the question being posed before a decision even gets considered.
Right. And by the way, I think they still use this method, so I don't think it's outdated. Only the article seems old. Drucker, I believe in this, points out that you get this immediate sense that he doesn't believe in the American management being able actually to adopt Japanese methods. And he hints at that all the way through. It's mostly, however, a research article, just kind of him going in, studying, watching American management, Japanese, and documenting what are the difference between the two approaches. So, Zach, I'll leave it up to you to give what Drucker's offering was so that people who haven't had time to read it can catch up and maybe give us a little bit of what you think the implications are.
Totally. So the whole point, I think, of what Drucker was saying here is that the Japanese management style at the time in 1971 seemed frustrating to Western business eyes, but actually he was trying to reveal that there was much more to learn, and instead they could be great teachers of making effective decisions. So, for example, Drucker points out that the speed of the Western negotiation process versus the Japanese. So he kind of shed as much of a light on this as he could. He said, and he talked about during the negotiations for a licensing agreement, for example, a Japanese company will send delegation after delegation for a conversation and extensive note taking. So during this phase, it can often lead to a Western business leader's, you know, becoming frustrated with the length of the process and so on. And at this stage, however, the Japanese business is actually gathering consensus from the quote unquote appropriate people before the negotiation terms are finalized and the decision is even made. By contrast, once the decision is made for a Japanese business, they are already in what Drucker calls the quote unquote action phase and are ready to make it operational. Meanwhile, Western leaders are often left trying to gain consensus with the, again, appropriate people after the terms have already been set by management. And this actually leaves Japanese business leaders super frustrated with the Western business leaders' slowness in operationalizing their decisions.
Yeah. Is it fair to shorthand it by saying that the Japanese do a long assessing and then a quick deciding and implementing versus the Westerners tend to have short assessing, or so it appears, and then it will be a long deciding and implementing, or maybe I've got those backwards. Why does he see Americans not able to do this Japanese way or even to understand it? And do you agree with this opinion?
I guess from what I read, Drucker sees much of the Western management style, actually specifically American, I think is what he's talking about in this article, being about executives making lots of small, quick decisions and longer implementation periods of having to sell, quote unquote, those ideas to other managers or maybe even their workers. Well, at the time, he saw many Western companies trying to approach a more Japanese style of deeper consideration. He was giving it their due. This process ultimately siloed into task forces and long-range planning committees and strategic groups that then brought back that information for management to decide. The issue, as he saw it, was that the Japanese process, again, quote-unquote, pre-sold critical decisions through a longer process of upfront shared consideration through consensus versus Western managers having difficulty selling their decisions after the fact.
Hmm. And both of these, of course, are selling. Hierarchy is still pretty powerful. I noticed a couple of things that as I was reading through it. So the first thing I think is fun to mention is Drucker created something called management by objectives. And we don't call it that today. It really just means cascading work to do and putting an objective where each part does its own objective and hopefully it adds up. He also created a lot of what we currently call distributed leadership. He called it distributed work. And his most well-known is the idea he coined the term knowledge workers. He still was using Frederick Taylor methods of things are like machines, but he was saying people's behavior is managed by managers, where before managers had been managing the manufacturing process, they're now managing the knowledge process. What's interesting also to me is the exact same time in 1964, where we were running teams at P&G that were really based on a very different theory of management. They departed quite a bit from this. And Drucker was working in academia, therefore studying things, interpreting, publishing, you know, reporting all the practices he observed. But we were at that same time, starting in 1964, I should say, we were working in industry as educators, not as researchers, but as teachers in a work setting. But we were using a very different epistemology. You all heard us talk about it. You hear me spit in my microphone, right? Not research and publishing, not interviewing people and observing, but instead producing simultaneous learning and doing. In other words, we were focused on developing people in their inner process and on their ability to reflect rather than the outer process and on behaviors.
So I've actually studied both kinds of theory. And the difference for me is that Drucker's method still lacks the inner perspective of an awareness of the worldview he's unconsciously deploying in his research. So in the research world, there's actually very little development, if any. And there's an interpretation of knowledge and recommendations that one makes from that. So he's focused primarily on behavior change and how Western leaders can enact that, as opposed to our way of approaching business, which is about the development of will, being, and function for the ongoing contribution towards the entities and systems in which we are intertwined. In Drucker's case, he's still trying to recommend different methods for managers to externally determine worker behavior, which, as we've talked about at length on this podcast, gets us into all the same kind of societal ruts we continually find ourselves in. As opposed to our worldview, which sees each individual as unique and on a path towards greater and greater orders of contribution to the ongoing evolution of systems.
You know, that's really helpful, Zach, because you're making obvious it's really seeing it differently, like you're looking for something differently. We do share some things with Drucker. One is the belief that thinking is the source of our success or our shortfalls. He was famous for saying, if people are having trouble, it's starting with their thinking. What is interesting is that Drucker never presented the idea that thinking and being, he never understood that thinking and even my state of being has a structure that if you can understand it and teach people, learn to see it, it can be developed. So we're not stuck with whatever thinking we've got and we have to get another person that thinks better. that inner working of our being can be developed in all people. And he tends to work more on the surface, that thinking was changed by knowledge. That's where the idea of knowledge worker came from, more knowledge, better thinking. And of course, that meant learning had to be lifetime. So you cram knowledge forever, I guess.
Yeah, but he also, I think, mostly offered executives advice on how to structure work to get the most out of people and give managers the idea that they were the leaders of people and their job was to take care of them. It was this kind of benevolent hierarchy for good, ultimately. I don't remember any idea that he developed that discussed how all people can lead, however. You instead manage them as resources while taking care of them, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's the way I read it also. And by the way, I have to remind people, that was revolutionary at that time, that they weren't machines. They were knowledge, you know, we had the whole computer thing coming in. He was really just running into, as he was coming into his world, he was probably, I couldn't find any references to it, but you can see it in his work. He had run into John Watson, you know, the founder or the at least popularizer of behavioral theory. And those ideas were spreading. The behavior is like wildfire. He switched it from not being manipulative to being for good. But still, I think that was what was going on. Do you see any clues to that in this article, and what does that lead to?
Yeah, so I touched on this a little bit, but he talks a lot through his kind of Western eyes about having to sell, again, his words, yeah, quote unquote, an idea, right? So the Japanese process pre-sold a change to their relevant management teams, while the Western process has to sell a decision after it's made. In both cases, Drucker sees them as externally determining behavior, which he's actually recommending. And this is rooted in a behaviorist or hierarchical mindset. So I think the modern instantiation of what we see today is kind of analogous to OD practitioners now go the other way with trying to build consensus-based processes to try to get, quote unquote, all the voices in the room. But unfortunately, the decisions are still made hastily at the executive level with this information and ultimately still leading to low levels of adoption, too many fragmented initiatives, and burnout.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, he also frequently said that all institutions, this is on his plus side, including those in the private sector, have a responsibility to the whole of society. I mean, the fact is that Drucker wrote in his 1973 book, Management, Task, Responsibilities, Practices, that in a modern society, there is no other leadership group but managers. And if the managers of our major institutions, and especially business, do not take responsibility for the common good, no one else will, unquote.
I think it all says it all right there, really. So if no other workers have leadership potential, how can they be considered anything more than automatons? Right? So what's funny about this is the article is that Drucker offered the idea that, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think he did this in the late 80s or 90s, several years after this article, but does not speak to culture at all here. He describes it all in behavioral terms, as in how they do decision-making. So culture is not spoken to as a way of being, but as a method for behavior change.
Right. I'm hoping this doesn't take us off too far, but when I was reading this, I kept thinking about a contemporary of Drucker's, Edward Hall, who was looking at culture through a lens of a metaphor, an iceberg. He called it the iceberg theory. So think about one third, one third, one third, and the bottom two thirds are below water, and the upper one third is above water. So there were internal and external factors to him. And there also were things that were learned consciously and unconsciously. And to him, this was how culture came about. And the external is often learned implicitly, like in your family, in your church, in your school. And the way that Drucker speaks of this, there's no inner work. There's just the behavior. And that's what I see Drucker describing in this article. Hall is saying something that I believe Drucker is missing, which is everything below the water.
Right. So you're referring to beliefs that shape our behavior in Hall's terms, which are all implicitly learned. So if Hall's right, it seems the beliefs that differentiate these two cultures are, in the case of the Japanese business leaders, that the process for going about understanding the nature of the question is more important, while the Western style believes that arriving at a shift and decisive answer is most important.
Yeah, there's also the thing about getting everybody on board before you make any decisions, I think, part of their belief.
Yeah.
Anyway, below that, so Halls has on top the behavior, and then he has, as you just said, he comes down to the beliefs. And then he has on the bottom, the part on the ocean floor, is about thinking and values, which then influence our beliefs and ultimately our behavior. Drucker does not speak to any of this except to say thinking is the source of problems. Improve your thinking. Of course, critical thinking skills were not a hot topic in 71. I know I was there. Much less system thinking or living systems thinking.
So what seems important in decision making for Drucker is the ways in which it could be engineered. Anything else around that or where it's sourced is either disregarded or irrelevant.
Yeah, I think you're right. My take on this, and I'm calling it a report. It's an article in Harvard Business Review, but it was a professor's study and then a report of these two different cultures. If you wanted to be able to understand them more completely, for me, you do have to nest them, but it's not an iceberg. They're kind of three nested ideas where we examine culture as a better way to cross over. Let me do it this way. Envision three rings, kind of like draw three nested rings in the air in your head. The outer ring, which represents the one that's most influential because it's most significant, is culture itself in terms of rituals, taboos, status, totems. We've talked about that before. Then the middle ring is corporate direction, which we believe is distinctive for each business. And he didn't actually put that as part of his study.
Right. So you're saying the body of the whole has a shared understanding of where they're headed or not, ultimately. This shared understanding determines the way of behaving culturally. So when there's not a shared understanding, then you end up having to sell, right, your decisions and ideas to people, like Drucker is saying.
I agree. And that's why we start so much with people looking at how is your culture? Where do you want to change it? How does it support your corporate direction of the whole? And then below that, on the smallest ring, and again, these are nested, so they're all interacting, is what we call framework thinking and shared language. If you think about in Japan, they are a very homogenous culture. They literally speak the same language. They have the same mental models in their head, where here, any company you go into, there's not going to be much shared. You're going to mean different things by the same words. In our school, you know, the work you and I are involved in, we work indirectly on that. So we're working underwater using Hall's model. It feels like that sometimes. We're not working directly like Drucker was on behaviorally on what people should do. So we don't offer any best practices. People say, what are your best practices? They have none. We have no procedures. So when we're educating in our forums, we're building capacity of people to think for themselves, not follow the pattern we give. We give no models because models give you the answer. Do this in this order. It's connected to this. We use framework thinking, which we've talked about in other shows, where you're really being able to, as a group, follow a thinking process. Here's the framework we're going to think through, but each person has their own answers inside that, but we're not lost and wandering around and changing subject. This fosters better self-expression because everybody's on the same place in the framework at the same time. But it's amazing. It creates a lot more innovation. And people just don't have trouble staying in the same process, aligning together in their how they're going to assess, examine, explore. Because in the framework, they're with a framework, they're very explicit. They say, this is how we're all going to think together. And after years, it becomes implicit eventually because they can read one another's framework thinking. I know this sounds a little weird, but if you're one of our organizations, people tell me when they leave, they go crazy if they go to work somewhere else because there's no order in organizing to thinking. But it does provide the speed also. It may look a little slow, but it provides the speed that Westerners need and the depth that Asian cultures like the Japanese seek simultaneously.
So I think sharing an example might actually be helpful here, Carol. Do you have one of this kind of round decision-making to help tie all this together? So, for example, we use a series of tetrads, which are four-term frameworks that organizational members or teams use to gain a depth of understanding and build alignment as they go and be whole and complete in their work. So how about we approach it from that lens?
I like that idea, Zach. I have another seventh-generation story that I don't think I've ever told, or certainly not very far along, where they were, seventh generation team, were visiting with SC Johnson, who most people know. They create room deodorizers, and now they have Raid and a bunch of other stuff. But seventh generation was looking at merging some product lines or creating a partnership with them. That's what they came for. But SC Johnson came in assessing and looking at how they might buy seventh generation and incorporate it into their company. Seventh generation leaders all walked in holding this tetrad in their head as a way of listening to what it was they were saying personally and what SC Johnson was saying. I want you to be able to visualize this. So they held a framework that looked like a diamond laying on its side. In other words, a little longer from left to right than it was top to bottom. And on the right-hand side is something called the goal. The goal is, what are we having this conversation about? And it didn't mean in terms of an answer. It meant something about, you know, why are we even in the room? And not what is the ultimate goal, although you'll see it did connect to that. It allowed them to dig deeply because they had a really clear corporate direction, and that was to be a trusted voice for consumers on the working of sustainability products and creating and using those products, because consumers didn't trust all the advertising and things that were going on. So seventh generation had a very transparent way of being. But they realized that the conversation they were in it was taking them toward, wait, they need to do this broader thing for the industry. They needed to start to try and influence other manufacturers because they could feel the disconnect. This was leading them away then from partnering together. They moved and they debriefed later and said, all of us could see at the same time the goal had moved from making a few products and co-branding into, wait, what is it we have to think about for the industry as a whole? So SC Johnson was listening all the time for how to get them to sell themselves, right? Their mind was not moving because they came in with a fixed idea. Noticing that they were not aligned because they had this framework helping them on what decisions they were working on became core. So the seventh generation team noticed this and was moving toward this larger idea, and almost together, they report, stopped talking about partnering.
And on the left side was the ground of the decision. We call that where the highest potential place to start and launch the work for which the decision is needed. I remember you saying that in dialogue with seventh generation, they realized that for them, it was about raising stewardship among other companies for educating people and not about competing to sell more products. The conversation showed that competing was actually at cross purposes. So instead, they ended up shifting the goal on seventh generation's part to proposing a shared campaign with Whole Foods to have all manufacturers educate consumers.
Right. And all that happened because they had a shared framework that was able to be used, not the answers they brought in, but a way of thinking. So let's go to the top of our little flattened diamond here. And that one is where you get kind of the overarching. It'd be a little like the values, but it means what is overarching, like for them, it was climate change, democracy, that are the kind of things that were infusing their decision process. It was changing and helping consumers become deeper green buyers. But it also got the attention of all household product manufacturers as part of a good society. And so they knew they had to work with an industry and move everything away from individual competing efforts. You know, it's so fun to hear the leaders who were on that trip feeling the pressure coming at them from S.C. Johnson, which was not coming actually from even a line position of them, but certainly not with seventh generation. And S.C. Johnson is a wonderful company. They have tons of great products that are green, but they weren't seeing it clearly in this meeting as something they could work on together. It was, you know, trying to get them to be sold. But the members of seventh generation had this shared framework. They had a shared language about what words meant, and they could organize on the fly and evolve, much like the Japanese did, by the way. And as they worked, they shifted an understanding about what was the important question. They moved toward what was their real purpose. What was the decision? It was no longer had anything to do with the same decision. But they never lost focus on being able to work together because of the shared framework they had.
Well, I know Seventh Generation then reached out to Whole Foods and did a series of in-store demonstrations that included six non-toxic brands working actually together. That was the instrument on their framework, on their tetrad. That was a shift since they went in thinking it was actually a partner contract. So they had to manage the not so subtle overtures to sell themselves while shifting the levels they were engaging, because they were shifting in real time what their goal was based on their corporate direction. That Whole Foods set of events put the intention of the industry as a whole on notice. So they were able to bring in thousands more buyers into the deeper green world because they trusted the industry more. And all the while, they were meeting Seventh Generation's corporate direction, which they called getting trustworthiness into buying decisions.
So we add to Drucker's idea out of playing with this example, what it means to have an understanding of worldviews and to draw from each culture. I really find that using Halt's ideas is kind of helpful at evolving Drucker's work here and in how decision-making processes and the unconscious beliefs really are affecting so much we can't see. It turns out that a combination of the process of the two, Japanese and American, is much more effective and better for managers, but also makes it possible for everyone to be involved, not just the managers, which, you know, Drucker was a management guy, and for everyone to be working on caring about society.
Wait a second, Carol. The story doesn't end there, right? Like, what happened when S.C. Johnson actually attempted to buy Seventh Generation?
Ah, yes. Okay. I wasn't clear on that, was I? Seventh Generation leaders, as they left, came back and they talked about the culture of S.C. Johnson. And not that it was a horrible culture, but the framework thinking allowed them to see the differences to themselves, and they felt less whole and complete, and it felt a bit under the table, you know, to be trying to maneuver them in a particular way. And they weren't up for sale at that point anyway, but it did lead them to thinking better about an exit strategy or two, if that ever seemed right. And the conversations with other suitors followed, because they took off, they were selling so much product, getting so much press, that a lot of people wanted to buy them, paper product companies, other personal care products. What they were able to do is make explicit and clear about what they were willing to do, and it had to do with creating something much bigger with the industry itself making it happen, not just Seventh Generation. So when the time came, they had a great aligning process with Unilever, which was very explicit. Even though they had a pretty bad series of bumps and spills with Seventh Generation's board, some great outcomes came, including Jeffrey Hollander, the founder of Seventh Generation, was placed on the Unilever board because they wanted to keep that kind of clarity and shared process that was explicitly used in decision making.
So let's summarize kind of a redo of Drucker's work using some later ideas and the influencers in decision making that start explicitly with culture and consider how the decision making and decisions are created or reinforced in culture. Right. So all the while, the teams should actually hold in mind all members involved and the corporate direction of the business. Finally, they need to use a shared framework and language to ensure the teams involved are thinking in the same way, not the same thoughts, but with guides that are using, they're basically using as a light for all the dark corners. It allows the decision-making to be fluid and evolve the possibilities as conversations shift and reorder, while still staying on course towards understanding how it will play out in execution.
Sounds like the best of both worlds. I want to thank Alex for sending us this article. It was great finding. We may not be done with it. We'll see. And thank you, Alex, also for joining now our change agent community where we can have more of these ongoing conversations. We look forward to meeting you. Business Second Opinion has been so well received that I've decided to create a YouTube channel in my spare time. It'll be based on my book, The Regenerative Life, which has hundreds of stories were involved in its creation, including Zach and his kids are in it. It will be interviews with people who experience using my free set of workshops on the subject on the nine roles in the regenerative life, them applying it in their life and then telling us a story that we can tell on YouTube. It is to inspire people to examine and to be able to change their own life with understanding their deeper beliefs and practices and living the way they really want to live their life.
And we're actually launching a new community for parents and couples, family pods, who are organized around the same children, and community pods of multiple family pods who learn and grow together. So if you're on Carol's newsletter, you can learn how to sign up more for the free workshop on October 23rd. Also, your organization can sign up for the book club for the regenerative life using an extensive workbook and video online workshops for free. There's 50% discounts on bulk buyers through Carol's publisher. You can find out more at carolsanford.com.
And let's be sure to thank Numi Tea for sponsoring our show notes for the third year in a row. Thank you.
This has been Business Second Opinion.